You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Monday, so it's time for Shapiro World with David Shapiro, who's the Deputy Chairman of Sasfin Securities, which is located in the salubrious surroundings of Melrose Arch in Johannesburg, probably the entertainment hub after Sandton City of Johannesburg. I spoke to David a couple of... I tried to phone David around about 6-7 minutes ago, which I normally do at around about 4 p.m. South African time, and he wasn't answering, but he came back to me and he said that he'd been on the telephone to Switzerland. Obviously, one of his bankers had phoned him and said, Mr. Shapiro, your account is full. Please do something about it. Hello, David.
They wanted to know if they could reduce my fees.
We find ourselves on a day which I always find extraordinary. Why not put the public holiday on the Monday, for goodness sake?
I don't know.
Because it's non-productive. It really does disrupt the economy in a small way, but in a small but meaningful way.
In a big way.
Yeah.
You know why? Because once people take off the long weekend, because Monday becomes a non-working day, they go off on Friday at lunchtime.
Exactly.
So the holiday starts Friday, 12 o'clock, right through till Tuesday, you know, and so you're actually losing 2.5 days plus, you know, weekend and that, and there's very, very little happening here, and you can see it in the amount of the announcements that are coming through, very, very little. There's plenty of action on global markets. For them, it's not a holiday, but for South Africa, it's a very serious issue. You know, every time, even if it's a Wednesday, people tend to make a long weekend of it. So, yeah.
There are certain days that should be marked on the day that they occurred. And we know that. There's a certain days that are incredibly important in South Africa's development, South Africa's history. But I do believe that the streamlining of public holidays could be more efficient. And because we're a consumption-based economy, a Monday off would actually be a boost, a regular Monday off instead of, you know, I think there's 12 public holidays in South Africa and that coincides with 12 months. There should be perhaps 12 Mondays. You can't do that with Christmas. You can't do that with certain, as I say, socially important days in South Africa's history. But there's something can be done. To have a public holiday on a Tuesday at the end of September, to me, is complete madness.
No, I agree with you. Look, they should follow the route that they take in the UK, where you have a so-called bank holiday. And I think it happens in the US as well. They have the Monday. So it's, unless it's July the 4th, Independence Day, and or the Thursday, which is Thanksgiving. But everything else is well organized. So, yeah, it's a pretty dull day. You can see by the parking when I drove in this morning, you could see how many people were absent. There was all the bays were empty. So, and strangely enough, the restaurants were full at lunchtime. Went in across the roads.
What did you have? Pizza and, again?
yeah, because everybody, all the school kids are away as well. They're not at school. So, everybody running around Melrose Arch at Tiger's Milk, you know, having burgers or Mr. George or Tasha's, wherever they are.
Yeah.
So quite a holiday atmosphere around here, but the offices are empty.
And the Stock Exchange News Service announcements on the shenit.co.za screen and every other screen as well, completely empty. There's a notice of an annual general meeting here. There's a change to the board there. Yeah. There's share dealings by a director somewhere else, but there's absolutely nothing. No trading statements, no results. And quite right too. We've come to the end, I think, of the companies that have half year and full year results at the end of June. Now, what have you got to look forward to? I don't know. Maybe the end of the quarter and
a couple of August. Something. Yeah, there are a couple of August companies that will come through in that. But the majority are June and December companies. So you get February and August here and there. You might get a March and September, but overall, not much happening. Look, it's a pretty down day here.
Yes.
And I'm not quite sure. I can't get to the bottom of it. To me, I think a lot of the selling is as a result of movements we saw last week in the market. But we're losing a lot of ground here. And a lot of the shares that made up ground in the few days of last week have given up those kind of gains. So it's difficult to get a grip on the market. It's also difficult to get a grip on global markets. Europe under quite a bit of pressure, Lindsay. That's on some poor economic numbers that are coming out of France and Germany.
The PMI numbers, in other words.
Awful. Manufacturing numbers, terrible. And I think the the focus is now turning on the ECB for more stimulus. And I don't think it's, in fact, it's not on the ECB. It's more on the governments themselves, the German government, to start upping the, you know, to start giving fiscal concessions and start stimulating on that side. In other words, move away from their very, very tight rein on the economy. You can no longer leave it to central bankers. Government have got to start taking action. You saw it in India. India reduced tax rates and that. America's already done it. So some kind of concessions are going to help if they want to keep the European economy turning over. So that's where that's a negative side of it. America holding, you know, it's there's mixed data coming. There's nothing of pressure, but I mean that's all we've got to look forward to today.
Yes, well, I'm looking at whenever I need some sort of sensational headlines or something to hang my hat on when it comes to interviewing on the international stage, I go to CNBC.com. They used to employ me, and I do like CNBC. The trade war is weighing like a big dark cloud on the global economy, says Christine Lagarde. You're starting to get evidence of that now, yeah. David, at the corporate level. Yeah. Little bits and pieces you hear about every day, you think that's because of the trade war, and we don't know in the next few months exactly how this will play out, but it's undoubtedly weighing on the global economy.
It weighs in terms of sentiment. In other words, people are uncertain, and when you're uncertain, you do nothing. So it holds back on business investment. I don't know whether they've interpreted the actual trade numbers. You know, you'll see it in South Korea's numbers. You'll see it in places like Singapore, which are trading nations and which are direct benefits of increased trade. You're starting to see it in all the GDP numbers. You'll see trade starting to fall. But a lot of it can be resurrected at literally a drop of a hat, simply because once confidence comes in and a deal is done, then people feel that it's not going to affect their supply chains and they get on with business. But at the moment, businessmen are dead scared to make any kind of business decision simply because of what it might mean down the line. So, yeah, it is causing uncertainty. And I don't think it's penetrated Mr. Trump's head yet. I don't know what his end game is. I don't, you know, no one can read him. No one can, you don't know what it's, where this is all leading. And even, you know, common sense people, or put it this way, he won't listen to common sense. You know, it's all a political game. It's all about being reelected or some kind of board game where the winner takes all at the end. So who knows?
Yeah, it's actually very, very simple. It's almost like South Africa, where you could, at the stroke of a pen, remove all sorts of legislation and increase the ease of doing business in our country, our lovely country. Yes. But people don't do it because of political pressure from certain factions within the august institution of the African National Congress. But it's now time to say, yeah, legacy is one thing, but forward-looking policies are another. So, yeah, anyway, let's get that out of the way. The big story this weekend, and it's not Donald Trump for once, and it's not Arsenal scraping a victory against a relegation-threatened Aston Villa. It is, we'll come to that later, it is the Thomas Cook story. Now, this tells you something about Brexit. It tells you something about the travel industry. It tells you something about a company that didn't reinvent itself. It became a giant, great, lumbering, inefficient blob. But this company, David, was formed in 1843 by Thomas Cook, and he started to organise little excursions on trains, on steam trains in the United Kingdom, 1843. Fast forward, it survived two world wars up until 3 a.m. this morning, South African time, employed 21,000 people. It ran hotels, it ran tour operations, it ran an airline, and suddenly, at the drop of a hat, as you said earlier on, 600,000 people worldwide, 600,000 people worldwide are stranded with nowhere to go. Their planes have been impounded, and the Civil Aviation Authority of the United Kingdom has to rescue 150,000, 160,000 British people with 45 planes over the next 2 weeks. It's quite staggering, the scale of this collapse.
Well, I, to be honest, I didn't imagine that they were as ubiquitous as that. In other words, that so many people would be stranded on Thomas Cook tours.
Yes,
because one could detect the changes that were taking place in terms of people booking their own trips on booking.com or Expedia or all the other online booking agents doing their own airline airline bookings. I didn't realize that it affected them to such an extent. And also the number, as you mentioned there, that people have been stranded as a result of that. So it is something that one would have expected. I don't think those tours take place anymore. I think that it is being replaced. It is an aging industry. But it's tragic that a company of 150 years, I suppose, has gone the way of Kodak and all the other companies that we can associate with, Luddite companies or companies that just didn't change the way that they do business.
Exactly.
So, yeah,
right.
Very sad.
It's extraordinary. I know, Tom, they invented.
There must be, what's the name? Do they still issue good old traveler's checks, or is that something of the past?
I think that you still can get traveler's checks, but
I wonder how many people have still got them stashed in their safes.
I don't know.
And what you do, you don't know. Remember American Express? We used to travel,
yes,
we would always get American Express traveler's checks, and you'd countersign them and either go to a bank or some companies or some retailers would actually take traveler's checks. They were cash. They were literally cash. Mm. But that was where they made their name together. I mean, it was a huge part of their business together with American Express.
It's very interesting, actually, the way that the world changes, because I saw something on the BBC the other morning which said that 28% of transactions in the United Kingdom are now conducted with cash, whereas 10 years ago it was 75%. And eventually, and they were, the reason they were saying this was because of the demise of the ATM. I mean, there are still people, I mean, I still go to an ATM. I like to have a bit of crinkle in my pocket so that I can give the chap at the pub,
leave a few bob,
leave a few bob there behind the bar, a 50 rand note, something like that. Not that you get much for 50 rand these days, but you know what I mean? But it's almost a metaphor for what has happened to a company like Thomas Cook, because Thomas Cook, let's not forget, survived two world wars and also invented the package holiday for the Poms. There would be a lot of English people, British people rather, that wouldn't know where Spain was if it weren't for Thomas Cook.
Yeah, exactly. No, I can't fault you, but it is sad that it's gone that way. And but Lindsay, you have to look at the other side. You know, one of the shares that we own is booking.com, which is based, your part of the woods, in Amsterdam.
Yes, it is. Well, actually Rotterdam, but yes, anyway, go on.
Is it in Rotterdam?
No, yeah, I think it's a Rotterdam-based company, but I know it's part of another group.
It's
a listed entity. But anyway, yes, it's an amazing company.
I know, and it's what it does is it hunts and it finds packages, and you can get cheap hotel accommodation. You could get anything through, you know, booking it yourself. Just go online and say, this is where I want to go. I booked an air ticket through an international airline, and they sold my name to booking.com. And every day I get offers of packages and so on, you know, every day. And you can't get rid of it, giving you very, very cheap options. And I must say, where I've used a hotel, I've always used booking.com. The thought of going to a travel agent hasn't really struck me. Although there are times where we book our flights through a travel agent. But I think it would be – it's the way things are going. And it's a warning sign, I suppose, to other people there. And travel, you know, travel is booming at the moment. Travel is apps, particularly in the Asian markets. I mean, that's where you're getting the demand for aircraft. That's where Boeing and Airbus are scoring, in that the number of people leaving and I'm using Asia as a proxy here, but a huge number of people are traveling, particularly the Chinese. And they visiting, you know, then some of them are making long hauls, but most of them are just traveling within their region, from China to Japan to South Korea and all over. So it's today travel is a massive area. And, you know, you see those, what do you call them, ships or boats, you know, the dream boats. Those, yes. they almost floating cities.
They really
that,
are.
You know, that come in and out of the big harbors, full of tourists, and the package is very, very attractive. So you can't, this has got nothing to do with travel. It's complete opposite.
Yeah, there are three companies that really spring to mind. Booking.com is one, which I always use as well. And it's very interesting the way that they know. I mean, I booked, I can't remember what I booked. The last thing you book anyway, they'll pop up 3 days later and say, welcome home, Lindsay. Where is your next trip going to be? And they say, did you have a nice time in so-and-so? Maybe you should go there. There's another company as well, which is very prominent on television where I am, called Trivago. And I think in South Africa as well, Trivago is quite well represented. And there's then there is, of course, Airbnb. It's changed the way that we behave when it comes to accommodation.
Yeah. You know what? You know what's very interesting as well? You mentioned that, is that today, and this applies in all different spheres as well, is that people don't follow adverts anymore. You don't read adverts. What you do is you look at rating, and you'll look at booking.com, and you'll say, this hotel is given a 7.5% or 7.5 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 because they get hold of you when you return, Lindsay, and say, how did you like the hotel? You know, or how is whatever, give it a few stars rating, whatever it is. And that's, that also dictates and dominates where people go. So you rely more on what people who've used the hotel say than listening to the media or adverts or anything like that, you know, or journals. So you rely very heavily on other people that have traveled there or have used the services.
Let's have a look at the markets if we can. Now, the big thing that I thought this morning was that the Rand was threatening to change its big figure from 14 to 15. I think it was the euro-dollar exchange rate, which has broken 110 and seems to be mired below 110. In other words, 1 euro buying you at the currently 109.90 dollars. I don't know how significant that is, but it certainly seems to have been taken to heart by Rand traders in thin conditions. Currently 14.88, but the Rand's suddenly looking a bit vulnerable again, having looked so strong a week ago.
It has. And I think it's also to do with the dollar. I think where you get weak euro, where you get weak European data, you've also had a bit of saber rattling between America and Iran. We've got no idea where the trade war's going. It seems to be on a decent course, but there are a lot of issues in the air at the moment that are causing the nervousness. And I think, I don't know whether that's behind the sell-off that we saw in emerging markets, but it has taken the Rand from where it was about 14.50-ish to where we are now. It's, you know, it's stable at the moment. It's steady. There's no fresh news to knock it, but you would have seen gold also picked up a little. All the safe havens have picked up, and yields in the U.S. have come down a bit. So, yeah, but I must say it's there's not a huge amount to get our teeth into at the moment.
This is interesting.
We've got to wait now for the we start with the earnings season at the end of September. So in the next 2 weeks we go through the whole cycle again.
In the United States, you mean?
In the U.S., yeah.
Okay, the gold price was, I think, probably 1485 to 1490 last time we spoke on Shapiro World anyway. It's currently 1523, which is up $6. Yep. It was up $15 on Friday. So something's going on there. And the interesting thing about this, David, is that it's in the face of a strong US dollar. And, of course, there is an inverse relationship between the strength of the dollar and the strength of the gold price. It normally means that if the dollar's strong, the gold price is weak, not a bit of it. So something's going on behind the scenes here. Although it's still mid-range, 1,500 to 1,550, let's face it.
I think if you look at asset allocations of a number of leading banks, you know, particularly you can say the American and the European banks, they've suddenly upped the weight in gold. I think it's with interest rates so low. In other words, holding cash gives you absolutely nothing. I think they've taken a bit of a punt on gold and said you may as well be holding gold since it's not going to cost you anything to hold gold because there is there's zero return. So I think we've seen gold holdings pick up a bit, and I think that's behind some of the support we're seeing. It is a safe haven type of holding against the uncertainty. But technically, you hold gold when you think things are going to worsen. And it's that kind of asset. You know, if you're really fearful of where we are at the moment, you will be holding gold. Gold shares are up today here on the JSE, as are platinum shares. I think those are the only two green areas. Otherwise, if you look across the board, some big sell-offs in shares here. Not a lot of trade. Lindsay, you know, we had the re-weightings last week.
And yes, what happened on Friday, by the way? I was speaking to Nick Quinzer. You spoke to him on Thursday. Yeah. He was spot on, but I don't remember what the... He was at the Westcliff Hotel, so I think he forgot to give me the volumes on Friday. It was 57 billion on Thursday after the futures closeout. I wonder what happened on Friday. Probably quite big as well.
No, we had you know this is why it's so difficult for people like me to talk to you, because I don't really understand what's happening underneath the market, the trading side of it. So to give you an example, between 10 to 5 and 5 we have closing auctions, which is actually supposed to bring stability into the market to prevent you putting through prices and manipulating the market. But what we found now, and in most markets, in the last 10 minutes, massive trade actually goes through. So to give an example of what happened on Friday,
yes,
by 10 to 5, the volumes on the JSE were 23.4 billion.
Right.
By 5 o'clock, that's 10 minutes later, it was 63.6 billion. Yeah. So 40 billion rands worth of trade went through in the last minute. You know, in the last 10 minutes.
So 120 billion in 2 days. That's amazing.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of it was rebalancing. So I don't know what that means. But, you know, we saw huge amounts of Naspers and Prosus and Impalas and all those that influence the indices going through. So how they organize it in such a quick time, you know, in 10 minutes, I have no idea. But that's what we see. Luckily, it hardly hardly moved the actual indices themselves, but a lot of trade taking place.
Yes, and so, a lot of posturing actually before the day as well, because obviously people can have a look at the market capitalization of certain companies. For example, Sappi, which we spoke about with Nick on Thursday, and people knew that it was going to be dropping out, so they forward sold, if you see what I mean, and readjusted their portfolios or front run in a perfectly legitimate way, of course. The Sappi share price, which fell 8%. But anyway, it's a world that we couldn't have envisaged in the 1980s, David.
No. There's absolutely no ways that you could ever have done any deals like that. And, of course, this is all related to the derivative markets, to index trading, and something which you could only put through with a computer. You can never calculate these kind of amounts in your head, or even on a handheld calculator, or even on a laptop. So you need high frequency trading systems to actually push this kind of trade through. So it's the volatility at concern, you know, that goes through is a little disconcerting if you're watching it on a minute to minute, day to day basis. But I think over time we draw a line through that, and that's how you've got to approach the market. So, but again, today I'm saying to you, Lindsay, you know, the same thing. We're down about 1.5% here, which is way above anything we're seeing in the rest of the world. Yeah. And I can't, you know, I'm trying to make sense of some of these of some of the movements now, whether they are trade related or whether it's really fear of the fundamentals.
Well, if you fear the fundamentals, then the first thing that I woke up to this morning was a piece in the Business Day by Peter Attard Montalto from Intellidex, and I spoke to him a few hours ago. And if you go to ShareNet or you go to strictlybusinesspodcast.com under the economy, under the headline The Economy, you'll listen to an interview with Peter, who's based in London at the moment, but it's a South African company, Intellidex. He says, I think, no, things are not going to be all right in the end. And for the first time, I sensed a little bit of aggression from him or frustration from him. The government must stop faffing around, he said. And I tried to push him on this, but he wouldn't be too forceful in his views. But I sensed an underlying frustration again, having covered South Africa for so many years so well. Yeah, now is the time to act.
You know what? I think this is becoming widespread now. People are getting very angry, particularly those who are trying to make a living here. And you're getting absolutely no support from government. But support of government is creating an environment in which you can operate. I'm not saying they're acting against you in any way, but nothing has happened. You know, it's now the end of September, so it's almost 2 years since Cyril has taken over the ANC. And the euphoria, CR17. I always remember Colin Coleman from Goldman Sachs coming out you know, and saying, you know, watch this now, 3% growth, 3% okay. growth. And he was supported by a lot of other, and I'm not going at Colin in a personal way. I'm merely, you know, I'm saying that's how people spoke. And we've seen nothing of that. If you listen to Lesetša Kgaganyagwa last week, you know, we're looking at growth at 0.6% this year, and he's downgraded to 1.5% next year. That's hardly the environment. Manufacturing, mining, lagging. And what do we got on Friday? The biggest strike in banks in 99 years. You know, the banks are going on strike. So, you know, what does that do? That's not going to help us in any way. Mm. What they're moaning for, I don't know. They might have a legitimate claim. I don't know. If you look at some of these salaries that perhaps some of the bank leaders are taking, they may have a claim. But nevertheless, once more, when a bank goes on strike or the whole banking system, you paralyze the entire economy. That's not going to add to growth. That can only take away from our growth. So I'll be in New York on Friday. So be spending dollars, not rand.
Yeah, exactly.
Which doesn't stretch that far anyway.
That bank strike is quite an interesting one. Let me just read you the headline here. What to expect from the South African banking strike. South Africa's largest financial union, SASPO, will embark on a major banking strike on Friday the 27th. That's this Friday. I mean, maybe they just wanted to take a whole week off because of today's holiday. I don't know. In an interview with Business Tech, the union's general secretary said that employees from all the country's major banks and other financial institutions will be protesting over planned retrenchments in the banking sector and called for a moratorium on job losses. Look, this is going to affect the poorest people who still go into banks in rural areas and people that aren't savvy enough to have online banking or laptop banking or mobile banking, whatever it is. So I don't quite understand, but surely they could just sit down with the employers and say, let's do something. Maybe they just wanted a platform, and they've got a platform with us today.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what it – look, you know, I don't know what their particular gripe is. Retrenchments, remember, are taking place simply because we no longer have bricks and mortar banks and have been replaced by trading systems. So it was bound to happen. How far that stretches, you know, banks have mentioned, I think Standard has been the one who said they will be getting rid of people. I don't think it goes into the multi-thousands. I looked at Investec results. Have a look at Investec results.
Oh, trading update on Friday.
That was a pre-close. If you look at it, you know, you can sense, yes, Brexit is the UK operations are under pressure, but locally as well. Now, when you're starting to lose, I don't say they're huge employees. I don't think the people that work for Investec match the number of people that work for First Rand or some of the other banks, but still, in a tight environment like we're seeing now, where economy is not growing, they're bound to be retrenchments. You know, it's bound to happen where banks are not making money. So
it's not just that, David. Yeah. It's because, as you quite rightly said, that the bricks and mortar aspect of banking worldwide is slowly diminishing, just like the ATM is diminishing. You don't need so many ATMs anymore. And if you have a look at, for example, the Thomas Cook story, which we described in the early part of this interview, 21,000 people worldwide have woken up this morning to job.
Yeah,
I mean, they go into they go into their office, but Thomas Cook is closing its doors. 9,000 of those are in the UK, and it's simply it's natural attrition because of technology and the way that the economy is evolving so quickly and the way people do business evolves. And in South Africa, unfortunately, with innovations from companies like Capitec, for example, means they don't have to employ so many people. Very simple.
Exactly. Now, the problem is with the Thomas Cook people, those skills are not going to be needed. Lindsay, we saw it in our profession. You know, on the stock exchange in 1996, they did away with trading on the open outcry, and they introduced screen trading, which was a multiple more efficient than we used to have. And I remember those dealers, and you'll recall, I don't know whether you were around in those days, but in those times, those dealers, if you had a very, very good dealer, he could command huge salaries. Yes. And strangely enough, it was the dealers in the mining markets that were the best paid. Overnight, they lost their jobs. And overnight, having come from very, very prominent positions, they were unemployable. You know, they had to reskill themselves. And it was extremely difficult to do that. And so I've been through a profession in a very small way where we were hurt and had to adapt the whole way that we do business, you know, from that time. So yeah, it's going to hurt, but you can't take those skills anywhere. You have to reskill yourself, and you have to continually work on, you know, on learning new professions or new way of doing things. So yeah, it's going to happen. You know, that's where it is. It can go on strike. The dealers could have gone on strike. No one would have cared.
Okay, let's go move on to happier things. What a sporting weekend it was. I don't know if you're a rugby fan. I know you're a cricket fan.
I know
you're a football fan. You like rugby as well, right?
I like big events, sure.
I thought South Africa New Zealand was one of the most bruising games of rugby I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And I suddenly thought to myself, the old days of great big blokes, you know, just barging themselves around. I thought those days were still with us. But when I saw even the really big chaps on both of those teams, they still look really, really fit. It's a whole new world. That game makes American football look like a Sunday afternoon game of hockey or something. Wasn't it amazing?
It was. And you know, when you look at they are fit, and they have to be fit. I don't know what they're going to be like when they turn 50 or 60 and how the arthritis is going to hurt them. But it is a very physical. I'm surprised that America hasn't adopted this. You know, I suppose it's very hard to change traditions and that. Yeah. But I think when you see the quality of sportsmanship, you know, not sportsmanship, of sportsmen, and I don't know, whichever team played, it's quite remarkable. What I loved about it was, you know, when you say the physicality and that, but also their ball control, you know, and skill, amazing. And listen, the point I want to bring up, what worries me, this is 6 weeks of rugby, 5 weeks, you know, to actually get through that is my concern. Is you know, we already lost within I can't pronounce the chap's name, I forgot his name, you know, one of the one of our front, was it our front row? You know, me and the names are not that great when it comes to rugby, but I mean, we already lost one chap. How many other people will we lose before we get to the final? And I'm talking on both sides, you know, key players. I know this is today, it's a game of 23 players. You know, you always got eight reserves and you've got a squad of about 30 in that, but it can be disrupting.
I still think South Africa has a chance. Even though losing that first game, they may only come second in their group.
I still think they've
got a chance, because the first 30 minutes of that game, South Africa were outstanding. New Zealand couldn't get out of their own half. It was incredible, the Bokkers' performance. And I don't really it's my third sport. Anyway, England
but those two tries were just exceptional, and that's that they scored. In fact, it could have been a third, you know, the third try where they had that. But you know, don't write off New Zealand. You know, that's what I'm saying, and don't write off anybody. I mean, the English, all of them, highly qualified or well grilled packs, not meaning, I mean, teams.
I think so one team you can write off, though, is Manchester United.
Oh, God.
I mean, Manchester United against West Ham, they made such a fundamental error when they appointed Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as their manager because of emotional reasons. And I don't think it'll last till the end of the season. They lost 2-0. They were the most anemic, limp-wristed, useless-looking Manchester United side I've ever seen. I didn't like their kit. I didn't like their play. I didn't like their attitude. I didn't like everything about them. And I was pleased, because I'm not the greatest Manchester United supporter. And I'm pleased for West Ham, because they've got passionate support. They get 50,000-60,000 every week. But Manchester United were rubbish.
Too terrible. There's nothing there. There was absolutely nothing in there. And as a Man United supporter, I'm not a Man United. I mean, for a Man United supporter to have suffered that is so humiliating, because you know, Lindsay, that you've got no chance. This is 2, 3, 4 years away before you're back at the top, you get to the back. And I agree with you. I don't think it's going to come through Solskjaer. I don't think it really – I see Chelsea in a similar position.
Yes, but they've got Lampard, and they're playing. One of the reasons that Chelsea are doing so bad is because of the transfer ban, because of an indiscretion that broke UEFA rules. But I think Frank Lampard is a young manager, a naive manager, but a good manager, and I think he will take Chelsea to the top again. But he's got Tammy Abraham at the front, who's a 21-year-old who's nobody had heard of until August of this year. And I think they'll do okay. They nearly snatched a draw with Liverpool. So don't worry about Chelsea. Yeah. They were fine. What about Arsenal?
Because you must be terrible.
Well, come on. They have some spirit, and they beat Aston Villa 3-2. They came back from 2-1.
You don't want them in a position. I don't want to win a game. I don't want to win that way. You know, I want them to win by dominating and playing good soccer all the time. And that's a problem. Problem with them is that, you know, they're always going to concede 1-2 goals. They're never tight. And you always got to pray that they get through it. And that's exactly what we did, that they did. And thanks to some really skillful players up front. Yes. But I mean, that's not how you want to win. You want to get on there and you want to dominate from the start. You know, and you want to dominate, play good soccer as Liverpool do, as Man City do. You know, that's the kind of game. And I just honestly, when I look at Arsenal, I can cry. Yes, they came through it by sheer willpower, and also that Aston Villa were tiring a little. But anyway, they got the point. The other team to worry about is Spurs, eh?
Yeah, they're what, sixth or seventh? You know,
they don't know where they are.
They keep on conceding leads. I mean, they had a lead against Leicester. Leicester beat them. They had a 2-0 lead against a very ordinary Olympiacos side in the UEFA Champions League, and they ended up drawing 2-2. It's almost as though Maurizio Pochettino has been groomed for the Real Madrid job, and it's in the back of his mind. There's something going on there.
Yeah, but I said. At the end of last season, I looked and I said, you know, one season too much.
Yeah.
Just, and then the Dele Allies, who are such good players, they're just not coming through anymore. So many of the young stars are just not there this season, just absent. I don't know. And I'm an Arsenal supporter, but I've always liked Spurs. I've always been close to the club, known people there. And I just look at them and you want to slap them. You just want to slap some of these players. Listen, Harry Kane can score even on his back.
Oh, that was such a good goal. What a great goal that was against Leicester. Oh, my goodness me. He is the epitome of the sort of bulldog spirit. And him and Jamie Vardy up front.
He's Roy of the Rovers,
Would be exactly what I was thinking of, yeah. David, what are we looking at the moment, investment-wise? Nothing, really. Just wait for the end of the book. Nothing.
Very, very difficult period we're going through. Very difficult. And I'm not sure how we're going to pull. I'm talking locally. I'm not sure how we're going to pull out of this. I think a lot more problems here. I think even on the international scene, it's, you know what I mean? Even on the international scene, I think it's going to be tight for us to pull out of this. We know that the results season is not going to be that great. It depends whether we can just beat some of the expectations. So, we're just going to kind of bumble along, turn over until the end of the year. Difficult time. Trump can change it. Trump can change it. You know, by making some concessions on the trading side, I think, you know, things can change there. And just hope that you know, a little bit of confidence comes into the global economy. But I love Christine Lagarde. I think she's great. I enjoy listening to her. I think she's an exceptionally bright person. And you know, if I was a president of a country, I would listen to her. She's head of the IMF. She's going to be head of the ECB. She's the kind of person. She came to South Africa when she was a minister. I saw her for the first time there. She was actually, a trade minister in France.
Yes.
And I heard her speak. And she was great. And I've always followed her since then. And got a lot of respect for what she says.
Okay, David, thank you so much for your time on this very, very quiet Monday. Have a great day off. I don't know what day off it is tomorrow, but anyway, whatever the day
is.
Heritage Day. Look back at your heritage. Look back at the heritage and reflect everybody in South Africa. David Shapiro is the deputy chairman of Sasfin Securities in Melrose Arch, and that was Shapiro World. That podcast was proudly brought to you in association with sharenet.co.za. Visit strictlybusinesspodcast.com and subscribe to receive exclusive content straight to your inbox.